Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Karen Winters-Schwarz. Winters-Schwarz was educated at Ohio State University and has shared a long-time career with her husband in optometry. But she may be best known as a writer and powerful advocate for mental illness awareness. She is currently president of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Syracuse, and she's also the author of three novels that tackle issues of mental illness. Her first was called Where Are the Cocoa Puffs? A Family's Journey Through Bipolar Disorder, followed by Reese's Pieces, Love, Loss, and Schizophrenia. Her newest is a mystery novel called The Chocolate Debacle. It deals with schizophrenia and the mental health system. It was published by Goodman Beck Publishing earlier this year. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back, Tish.
Yeah, good to see you again. Now, you've been a longtime advocate for mental illness and an educator. What makes you decide to talk about this subject via novels?
I think that the magic of novels is that you can get into everybody's heads. I also do professional book reviews for New York Journal of Books, and I read a lot of memoirs. And the problem with memoirs, you're only getting one point of view. Mm. You're getting one perspective. And what I love about being able to do fiction is you can get into everybody's head and see how everybody is affected, not just the person who's dealing with the illness, but their family members, society. You know, in this book, I get into the village. So that's, you can really only do with fiction.
Yeah, yeah. And to me, I understand it from the point of view of that it's more accessible.
Right.
People will more likely read
right.
about
and
subjects
I'd like
to, like
this. I hope my books are engaging and the characters are engaging and people want to read it. And I sneak in a little bit of knowledge about mental illness without them even knowing it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's really, really good. Now, you wrote about bipolar and Cocoa Puffs and schizophrenia and Reese's Pieces. And you're tackling schizophrenia again in the new book. Why have you revisited that particular illness?
Well, in this particular book, you don't really ever know his diagnosis because he's been given almost every diagnosis out there from OCD to schizophrenia. But I think in this particular case, schizophrenia is the most maligned, it's most misunderstood, and it's the most stigmatized of the illnesses. It's a very scary word, and this being a murder mystery, and since he is arrested for a murder he may or may not have committed, that's the diagnosis I decided to go with.
Uh-huh. Why did you decide to make it a mystery? I find that really interesting. I usually don't read mysteries, but I found this quite compelling.
Right, and I don't usually read them either. Don't tell anybody that. But it was so much fun to write. I actually stole this story. I was at a NAMI conference, national one, a few years ago when Cocoa Puffs came out, and a woman came up. She goes, "I have an idea for a story." And I was like, "Don't tell me, I'll steal it." And she proceeded to tell me, and she never emailed. We were going to collaborate. And I sold it from her, but her idea was a parents whose child lives with them, a grown man, and he's arrested for murder, and they decide to solve the murder. Now, I didn't kind of go with that tack, but I thought, what a good idea. That's very interesting. So it was a stolen idea.
Yeah,
novelists do that.
Yeah, it's a hook, too, because it keeps people wanting to know what's going on with this guy. To tell us about the main character. His name is Trey Barkley.
Trey Barkley, and he is 26 years old, and he has a long history of mental illness. He has first break his second year in college. He was in Brown. But he's moved back home to his small community, which is set in Skinny Alice, New York. He does very well in his own little world. He walks dogs for a living. And his parents and him tolerate each other fine. And then he's arrested when one of his clients is murdered. And one of his, not the dog, but the owner of the dog.
Yeah.
And it goes into how he is affected by this and how the village responds to that arrest.
And might we add, this kid is, you know, even though he's a dog walker and living at home, he was brilliant.
Yes, he's brilliant.
Before he got ill. You have him, the illness starting at 19. Now, that's a typical age for somebody to be diagnosed, especially schizophrenia.
Or
right?
younger. Nowadays, mm-hmm. first breaks are happening younger and younger, and they're not really sure why, but it's very scary. We have a lot of childhood serious mental illness at this point in time.
To talk to us a little bit about schizophrenia, I know you're not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I know you know a little bit about this.
Right.
A lot of people think it's people hearing voices, but it's much more complicated than that.
Yes, it's much more. A lot of people get it mixed up with split personality. It has nothing to do with that. It's a totally different illness. It's more of a thought disorder. It's dissociation from individuals. You tend to withdraw. You tend to be very bothered by lights and sounds and noise. it's as if people are lacking a filter, that they get all stimulus at once. And so what they do is they withdraw. And the voices, hallucinations, delusions are a small part of the illness. And there's a lot of cognitive issues where they can't process information correctly. And it's detrimental to people who, most, a lot of people with it are brilliant, but they have a very hard time then dealing with the world around them.
Yeah, yeah. And you portray this really, really brilliantly in many
you.
Ways. Yeah. Because we can go inside Trey's head.
Right. And that's the beauty of fiction, like I said.
Well, tell me how you know some of this, though. I mean, you obviously have done research. You work with the Syracuse.
Yeah, I've done a ton of research. I've talked to bunches of people, a lot of people, about what they go through. I have many people write to me and tell me. I have family members who deal with it. And I have this really sort of strange ability to put myself into other people's heads and figure out how it would feel. You know, I myself have never heard voices, but I can imagine what it would be like. Mm. And I, for some reason, I have a talent for portraying that. I've had many, many individuals come, wow, you just hit that right on the nail, how I feel. And I went in with Cocoa Puffs, too, the teenager with the manic, she was manic through both of the books. And I have my moments where I'm slightly manicky, so I can totally relate to that.
Yeah, because a mental illness is a manifestation from a real human being, and we all experience
right.
small versions of some of these right. extreme things that happen to people with mental illness. Now, as you said, the character is accused of murder. Tell us about the fact that a lot of people do think people with mental illness are violent and prone to murder, and that's not really the case.
No, in fact, it's quite the opposite. Very, very few people with mental illness commit acts of violence, and almost all of those, up to 85%, are against a loved one, usually the mother being a victim. But we hear about those, the ones, the Adam Lances, we hear about that because the media loves to latch on to that. They love to latch on to the fear. It sells newspapers, it sells magazines, it sells...
And it's a simple narrative.
It's very simple, yeah. And... So we were all raised that mental illness people were scary and dangerous. And that's part of the reason why I write the books that I do, because what we are doing is we're over-criminalizing these individuals. And instead of diverting them to mental health care unit or community-based services, they end up in jail. Our justice system has quickly become our number one mental health care facility in the country, not just here in this area, but everywhere. And they're overburdened. They're overrun by these individuals. 35 to 55% of inmates have a diagnosed mental illness now, at least. It depends on the statistic. It's at least 50%. And the jails, they can't handle it, and they're not doing a good job, although they're changing things. And so part of the reason I write this book is, how is this individual treated? And he's treated actually very well in the book, but I don't know if he would have been arrested if it hadn't been for his history.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is that I think about the fine line, though, before the Disabilities Act and stuff came
right.
into being, when people were just thrown into mental institutions sure. and couldn't even get out, right?
Right.
So, you know, we haven't done enough, and we haven't gone the long mile that we need to go to help people with mental illness, but at least we're not putting people in asylums where they're not getting any care.
But in the same token, what we did was started in the 50s and went through the 70s, where we had massive deinstitutionalization, and that was part of what Kennedy tried to do. And what his idea was good. It was based on a soundness in that we should divert people away from mental illness or mental hospitals and put them into community-based services. The issue is there was never community-based services put in place.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the same thing right now in this area, especially in Syracuse, where they're trying to migrate beds, move them out of the area, children's beds specifically, so all the children go to one facility. So if you have a child who has to be hospitalized, you may have to travel 2 hours. And they're saying that because instead of doing hospital beds, we're going to do community-based services. So they're closing beds, but again, same thing again, they're not providing the community-based services.
Yeah.
There's not enough, and they're not out there working.
So
we're
people
seeing
have
the same thing.
Yeah, so it's a humane notion to change things, but we haven't set up the systems
right.
in order
and
to
it's
accommodate.
It's horrible to have to put people in the hospital, but sometimes that's the safest and best place for everybody involved. We have to have the beds available. And sure, you shouldn't be able to commit your loved one just because you're mad at them,
yeah.
but it is impossible to get your loved one into the hospital.
Yeah,
impossible,
yeah.
And they desperately need to be in a safe environment.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm glad the days are gone when men could commit their wives if they weren't conforming to what married life was supposed to be. All those old stereotypes. Now, it's interesting in this book how you discuss the fact that the main character, Trey Barclay, is diagnosed with all kinds of things through the years, and no one can really tell what's going on with him, and he gets these labels. He gets put on so many different kinds of drugs.
Right.
Talk to us about how prevalent that is.
Oh, that's incredibly prevalent. I know the majority of people aren't diagnosed until 10 years into their illness, and I've had people come up to me at conferences, and they tell me they have OCD, they have bipolar disorder, they have schizoaffective disorder and schizophrenia. Oh, and also I have an eating disorder. I'm like, wow. And I wonder how many of those are actually real and how many medications are they on? And I had a psychiatrist once at a book event I did tell me, what we psychiatrists do is we put the patient up, we pretend to him that he's a dartboard, we throw medication on and see what sticks. And that it's sadly very much still the case.
Oh, yeah.
We don't know what we're doing, we don't know what we're treating, we don't know what medications work. But more and more, the same medications are used to treat both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in a lot of cases. So I like to think of it as a spectrum. You have a little bit of bipolar disorder, and you go swing all the way to full-blown, the worst kind of schizophrenia you could have, and schizoaffective is when they can't decide, they give you that label somewhere in the middle.
The thing that bothers me about this, too, is the fact that some of these drugs absolutely alter people's lives, personalities,
absolutely.
Health.
Health is huge in the weight gain and in the metabolic changes, diabetes and heart issues. And people are dying 20 or 30 years earlier putting these medications. And they'll put you on one medication, and then you have a side effect. So they put you another medication with a side effect. And then, you know, one of my family members at one point, just a little teeny person, was on four different medications. I'm like, whoa, this is not right. And it's so prevalent. And it's so run by Big Pharm.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're not doing the research they're doing because there's not enough money being made on these meds. So there's not a lot of new medications coming out that are more effective with less side effects.
Oh, God. I know it's humble. I know people who've been thrown through the system and thrown every drug in the book.
Right. And so you can't blame people who are saying, stop, I don't want to take medication. You know, but then they end up in worst case. So what we really need to do is catch these people when they're young before they have to be on medication, before drugs or alcohol take effect. That's what we need to do, is increase education.
And talk to us about the fact that alcohol sometimes is part of the problem, too. People on these drugs are often trying to self-medicate with alcohol.
Oh, yes, self-medication is a huge issue. And you start with a child who's 13 or 14, they're starting to have prodromal syndromes. They may have a propensity for mental illness. And so they start having normal teenage angst, so they do the drugs, so they smoke marijuana very early. And there's huge, huge evidence that early marijuana use can trigger schizophrenia in a young person. Certainly LSD. There's not quite as much evidence with bipolar disorder, but bipolar disorder, people with bipolar do marijuana as their drug of choice and cocaine. It really helps stabilize them, keeps them a little high, doesn't let them get too low. It's a huge issue. And then you're trying to treat both things, drug addiction and mental illness, and then they end up in the jail system.
Yeah, I know. I've seen it over and over, and it's prevalent in this culture.
It's very
sad. Now, what do you think of the Americans with Disabilities Act in regard to how it's helped people with mental illness? I know it's helped a little bit with discrimination, but it certainly hasn't gone far enough, right?
I know. No, I think it helps on paper, but I don't think it really helps. I think that if you have someone, it's working for you, and you find out they have a mental illness, and you can get rid of that person so many other ways. It's not really helping. Again, it comes down to early education, basically breaking down that fear and stigma that's associated with mental illness. That these people are individuals. One out of four people have a diagnosable mental illness at some point in their life, but nobody talks about it.
Yeah.
One out of four family members have a first-degree relative with mental illness. Nobody talks about it. And if we brought mental illness out of the closet, like we have so many other things, then it wouldn't be so stigmatized. People would be more likely to seek help early, maybe not have to do the medication. And that's in the American Disabilities Act is just one little issue, doesn't really help, I don't think. In fact, and the HIPAA laws have made it much, much worse to get people treatment and get the care they need.
Uh-huh. And so you must be discouraged as an activist. I mean, you've been working on these subjects for so many years, and have we made any changes?
No, in fact, I have a saying that I pulled out of E. Fuller Torrey's new book, American Psychosis, how the government ruined the mental health care system. Anyways, it has this long, beautiful quote about how we treat mental illness and how it's stigmatized and how we try to hide them. And in the end of the, and you're like, wow, that's all so true. And then you look, and it was written in 1941.
Oh, my God.
And none of it's, everything in the quote is absolutely true still today. So this, and this is one of the reasons why I do what I do. And I do get to the point where I get so discouraged, like, oh, my gosh, why am I writing these books? Why am I going all over the country talking about it? But then I have one person come up to me and tell me how much one of my books has affected them and helped them, and how they pass the books on to other family members, and now their family gets it. It makes it worth it to me. It really does.
I know. It's a really nice and in somewhat benign way to communicate with people.
Right.
And not just slap them in the face with medical
jargon. And my books are subtle. They're very subtle. They're not, like, preachy at all. I really don't think so.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Winter-Schwartz. She's an advocate for mental health awareness and education and a novelist. Her newest novel is a mystery called The Chocolate Debacle, and it deals with the issue of schizophrenia and the mental health system. Now, I thought it was really interesting the way Trey goes off balance sometimes and says, I'm trying to find my core.
Right.
To talk to us about that. I totally understand what that means as somebody who doesn't have mental illness. But how does somebody with mental illness bring their pieces back together?
Well, I think the key to for people who recover from mental illness, and Trey, to my book, does very well, is to realize that they have a mental illness and realize their core is off, that their balance is off. Mm. Because it does come down to balance, to being able to know your triggers, to know eating right, exercising, medication may be a small little part. But the people I know who have recovered, they exercise and they eat well, and they sleep well, and they keep themselves together by knowing what can cause their triggers. So they withdraw from situations that are stressful. So Trey does a lot of that regrouping in the book, like when he's covering up the windows and covering up all the outlets because he's trying to cut down that stimuli and calm himself down because he knows he's about to lose it.
Yeah. Well, what about the people who aren't aware of how they're behaving, though? I mean, what would you advocate for that? There are people who don't have that kind of self-awareness, even if they don't have mental illness, you know.
Right. And that's actually a symptom to schizophrenia. It's called anosognosia, and I'm not sure I said that right. It's a very hard word for me. But they have totally inability to realize that they're sick. And those people, when they become a danger to themselves and or society, I believe, and this is very controversial, they should be forced into treatment, and that's where Kendra's Law comes into place.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a permanent law, but it is in the books right now, that forces somebody who's been in and out of the system repeatedly, shown to be self-destructive, to be on medication. If they don't go on medication, they either, one, go back to jail, which is really not a good place for them to be, or they have to go back into a mental health care facility. And it works, but it's very hard to get it put on. You have to go through a judge, and I don't know why a judge is deciding this, because a judge isn't a medical person, but that's how that is affected. But sometimes medication is necessary. But then again, people have a right, if they're not harming themselves, to live the way they want. I know an individual whose son, he lives in the woods, and he does perfectly well. He can't understand why he can't live where he wants to live in America, and he keeps getting kicked out of wherever he goes. All he wants to do is live his life.
Yeah, that is an interesting dilemma. People do, you know, society still wants people to conform.
Right.
And if you don't, they call you mentally ill.
Right,
and
exactly.
And that's, we go back to when
and we go back with that
people
stigma.
Could put people in mental hospitals if they weren't conforming.
And then you have to carry that label around with you the rest of your life. But I think now it's an easier label to carry, and I think the more we talk about it, the lighter it's going to be, and changes some of the terminology, too. Schizophrenia is a heavy word. I would love to see that change to another. It's still a very scary word and misunderstood. And it's really just something not quite right with your brain, like something cannot be right with your heart. And people don't stigmatize people with heart illness.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet people with a brain.
It's a thought disorder.
It's
and
a thought
they
disorder,
do need to find a more benign way of labeling it, if you will. I want to talk to you about this too. I know you're an optometrist, and you've been in the mental health advocacy, you know, world for a long time. How did you get into writing novels? Did you actually study? I know so many people who go back and get MFA so that they can write novels and get into that world, and you've done that. How?
Yeah, well, it's a really strange thing about, I guess it's 20 years. I keep saying it's 10, but it's probably 20 years ago. In my middle of my midlife crisis, and my daughters were teeny little girls, I woke up from this really intense dream, and it was so intense and powerful, I thought, I need to write that into the book. And that was actually my basis for Reese's Pieces, my first book. I wrote that story, and I decided, because a guy in my dream was acting really nuts, and I started doing research, and I decided to write about schizophrenia. Then it was 10 years later when I had family members, very close family members to me, become ill, that I wrote Where Are the Cocoa Puffs. And I just found out that I absolutely love to write. I mean, I love it. It's such a, not only is it cathartic, it's it brings you into everybody else's world, and you can get into their heads, and you can solve problems, and it's just amazing to me, and it's so much fun to write.
So it's a world that
and so I'm self-taught, but you know, it's a passion that you either have or you don't. Uh-huh. But I have gotten better.
But you must work with editors though, because there are a lot of people who are self-taught who can never get published, and you've had three books published, and they're very good books.
Thank you. I was very lucky. I sent the right query to the right person at the right time. It came down to dumb luck. That's all it is to get published. And of course, now self-publishing is more and more acceptable, but it is nice to be vetted and have a traditional publisher. And my publisher is wonderful, and we work very close together. And yeah, I totally need an editor. A writer is only as good as their editor. I work with a professional editor. She does my stuff before my publisher even sees it, because I need all help I can get.
Yeah. Well, I think it also gives you legitimacy, because you're writing about a heavy subject and you want people to read it, and you want people to know that you're writing this with some authority.
Yes.
And if you were self-publishing, people would go, oh, okay, great. Yeah. You know, a wacko's writing about wackos. You know, I mean, really, I can hear the cynicism.
That's true.
Now, to talk to us about the duties and some of the joys and scary things about being president of NAMI.
Oh yeah, that's and you've got it all. You said it all. The duties are huge, because we are a pretty big affiliate. We have over 500 members, and we have 20 people on our board, and we have a lot of things we're trying to do. But the joy is me coming in, not knowing anything, because I have never been a mental health care provider, and a lot of our board members are, psychiatric nurse practitioners, or they've worked at Hutchings. So I was very hesitant to take on the presidency, but I found that the best president is one who knows how to delegate, and I'm pretty good at that. And we're doing some wonderful things in Syracuse. We're trying to get some more children's beds in our facility in the Syracuse area. We're trying not to lose the beds we have. We really want to bring a mental health court into Syracuse, which is horrible that we don't have it.
To tell us what that would mean.
Well, what now happens now, if someone's arrested with a history of mental illness, they go through the regular court system and they're treated like a criminal. Uh-huh. And one of the biggest issues with people with mental illness is they're way over criminalized. They end up in jail way quicker than they should. And our justice system in Onondaga County is way overburdened. In fact, there's a bill asking for a $30 million extension to put a whole new wing on center just to house the mentally ill. And that goes back to what I was saying before. Our justice system is becoming our mental hospitals that were closed in the 1950s. And I don't think that's a necessarily good idea. What I'd like to see is that $30 million diverted into better community-based services, better in-hospital, get us some beds for critical care needs. In a hospital, these people are ill. They're not criminals.
Right.
And that's one of the things I'm working really hard. So that brings me a lot of satisfaction. We're working with the state legislative and local and hopefully on the federal level to get some of these things changed. And so that's been really rewarding. It's frustrating because we're a very small grassroots organization, very little funding. We're trying to write grants. We're trying to get grants. It's a lot more work than I ever anticipated. And it's all volunteer. I don't get anything for it except occasionally get a pat on the back. But I love working. My board is great. I love working with our NAMI family. It's a wonderful, wonderful group.
I think you're a great spokesperson, a great face for it, because you're so committed. You've written all these books. You're constantly going to conferences and talking about it. To tell us what kind of education systems are in place for NAMI. I mean, are you going into schools? Are you going to hospitals? I mean, I know a lot of doctors who don't know anything about mental illness.
Right, and that's another thing I'm going to bring up for 2000. 2015. But what we're working on really hard this year is a program called Breaking the Silence. It was originally written by a NAMI member, Queens Nassau NAMI, and it's a program that goes into the school that's got three different curriculum. One is upper elementary, one is middle school, one is high school. And I brought it into the NAMI about 4 or 5 years ago and actually got frustrated. I'm embarrassed to admit because I couldn't get in anywhere. But then we have a new board member, Dr. Steve Glatt, and he's a researcher at Upstate. And he grabbed onto this, and he has an intern working, and we are getting into the schools. We've got funding to buy the packets. They cost us about $60 to get it into a school, and we have it for free.
Wow.
And because we got the funding from OnCare, and we're working on trying to get another grant. And we're actually making headways, and the idea is to educate young and break down that stigma, get kids talking, get kids getting help before they start to need medication or do drugs and alcohol. So that's one of the biggest things that we've done this year that we've been very successful with.
Yeah. You know, I want to bring up this thing, too. I know somebody who knew that their kid had some mental problems but didn't want to get help because they didn't want the kid to be stigmatized and put into the system. What do you say to families that decide, I don't want to put my kid through that. She'll never get out of it. He'll never get out of it.
Like I said before, there is a certain label to carry it on. And again, you have to tell that mother or father, you need to do what's best for your child. And it's, you know, you don't have to jump into the mental health care system. In fact, it's quite hard to get into the mental health care system. The only way to do it is to be hospitalized or be arrested. But to start out with a child who needs help, you know, start seeing a psychologist, work your way to a psychiatrist. You know, you do it slowly and you try to get the help. NAMI has great resources of practitioners who will see the child. It's really, really, really difficult because sometimes parents are so desperate, they want their child in the mental health care system. Yeah. They want it, and the only way to do it is to get them arrested. I've had families who had to set up their son or daughter, you know that what's going to trigger them to get them arrested so they could get the help they need.
Wow.
It's horrible. You shouldn't have to get that sick. You should be able to get help. What we need, and I've said this over and over and over again, is a streamlined collaborative referral system between school counselors, teachers, psychologists, social workers, our clergymen, because a lot of people go to their priests or religious authority and tell them, I'm hearing voices, I need help, and they said they're told to go to pray more, and it doesn't usually help. And we need that referral system in our family doctors and in pediatricians to a mental health care provider. We do not have that in place.
Well, hopefully with your activism and some of the bills that may come up, I'm hoping things will change in this country for mental illness. Karen Winter-Schwartz, we're almost out of time. Any workshops, talks, anytime anybody can see you talking about this subject or reading from your book?
Right. I'm going to be at Barnes & Noble on Monday in DeWitt, and I'm also coming back to Buffalo Street Books in December in Ithaca, which I'm very excited. The date right now is not coming to me, but if you go to their website or email me, I can give you the date. It seems like it's...
And do share your website.
Yeah, it's just my name, www.karenwintersschwartz, and it's WINTERS and SCHWARTZ.com. So karenwintersschwartz.com. And you can email me. You can get to my website, and it has contact author, and all my events are listed on my website.
Well, great. Karen Winter-Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us again. Again, Karen's new book is called The Chocolate Debacle, and it talks about schizophrenia and the mental health system. And if you want to talk to Karen about these subjects, please get in touch with her. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.